look at the focus moon, it will blind you, he replied.
But if you could, if it wasn't, what colours would it be? What makes a blue sound?
He often used that one.
What does pain taste of?
Can you see the trees grow?
What secrets do stones keep?
And so on, sometimes growing excited, sometimes affecting boredom, yawning into his hand. All of it a game, rarely won, and at the end of it, always the same. Giljon crouched to be on their level.
Watch my finger,
he would tell them, and he would move it through the air in a descending line, so close his nail almost clipped their nose. The line wavered, jerked, pulsed, beat, never the same twice, but always familiar. What he was looking for in their eyes, Nona didn't know. He seldom seemed to find it, though. Two places in the wagon went to children selected in this final round, and each of those cost more than any of the others. Never too much, though. Asked for gold, he would walk away.
Friend, I've been at this as long as you've tilled these rows, and in all that time how many that I've sold on have passed beneath the academy arch?
He would ask.
Four. Only four full gloves, and still they call me the Mage Finder.
In the long hours between one part of nowhere and the next, the children jolting in the cage would watch the world pass by, much of it dreary moor, patchy fields, or dour of forest where screw pine and frost oak fought for the sun, leaving little for the road. Mostly they were silent, for children's chatter dies off soon enough if not fed. But Hesse proved a wonder. She would set her withered leg before her with both hands, then lean back against the wooden bars and tell story after story. Her eyes closed above cheekbones so large they made something alien of her. In all her pinched face, framed by tight curls of straw-coloured hair, only her mouth moved. The story she told stole the hours and pulled the children on journeys far longer than Forefoot could ever manage. She had tales of the Skithroll in the east, and their battle queen Adoma, and of her bargains with the horror that dwells beneath the black ice. She told of Dernishmen who sail across the Sea of Marn to the Empire's western shore in their sick wood barges, of the great waves sent up when the southern ice walls calve, and how they sweep the width of the corridor to wash up against the frozen cliffs of the north, which collapse in turn and send back waves of their own. Hesse spoke of the Emperor and his sisters, and of their bickering that had laid waste many a great family with the ill fortune to find itself between them. She told of heroes past and present, of olden day generals who held the borderlands, of Admiral Scheer, who lost 1,000 ships, of Noi Guin scaling castle walls to sink the knife, of Red Sisters in their battle skins, of the soft men and their poisons. Sometimes on those long roads Hesse spoke to Nona, huddled close in a corner of the cage, her voice low, and Nona couldn't tell if it was a story or strange truths she told.
"You see it too, don't you, Nona?"
Hesse bent in close, so close her breath tickled Nona's ear.
"The path, the line, the one that wants us to follow it."
"I don't..."
"I can walk in that place. Here they took my crutch, and I have to crawl or be carried. But there, I can walk for as long as I can keep the path beneath me."
Nona felt the smile. Hesse moved back and laughed. Rare for her. Very rare. She told a story for everyone then. Perseus and the hidden path. A tale from the oldest days. And even Giljon leaned back to listen. And one day, wonder of wonders, the 12th child squeezed into the cage, and Giljon declared his wagon full, his business complete. Turning west, he let Forefoot lead the way to Verity, soon finding a wide and stone-clad road where four hooves could eat up the miles double quick. They arrived in the dark and in the rain. Nona saw nothing more of the city than a multitude of lights. First a constellation hovering above the black threat of the great walls, and once through the yawn of the gates, a succession of islands where a lantern's illumination pooled to offer a doorway here, a row of columns there, figures hidden in their cloaks, emerging from the blind night to be glimpsed and lost once more. Broad streets and narrow, cut like canyons through the neck-craning height of Verity's houses, brought the wagon in time to a tall timber door. A legend set in iron letters above the door declared a name, but recognizing that the shapes were letters, took Nona to the borders of her education.
"The Countess, boys and girls," Giljon pushed back his hood. "Time to meet Partners Reeve."
Giljon pulled up in the courtyard that waited behind the high walls and ordered them out. Sida and Nona clambered down, stiff and sore. Before them a many-windowed hall rose to three times the height of any building that Nona had seen until she reached the city. The yard was largely deserted, lit by the flames guttering in a brazier set at the centre. Peculiar equipment lay abandoned in corners, including pieces of leather-bound wood the size and shape of men, set on round-bottomed bases. A few young men sat on benches beneath the lanterns, all of them polishing pieces of leatherwork, save one, who was mending a net as if he were a fisherman. Partners Reeve kept the children lined up for more than an hour before he emerged from his hall. Long enough for Dawn to infiltrate the yard and surprise Nona with the knowledge that a whole night had passed in travel. Sida fidgeted and pulled her shawl about her. Nona watched as the sun edged the ridge of the hall's black-tiled roof with crimson. Beyond the walls the city woke, creaking and groaning like an old man leaving his bed, though it had hardly slept. Partners came down the steps, always taking the next with the same leg. A heavy-featured man, tall and well-fed, with iron-grey hair, dark eyes promising no kindness, wrapped against the cold in a thick velvet robe.
"Partners!"
Giljon held his arms wide, and Partners Reeve copied the gesture, though neither man stepped forward into the promised embrace.
"Celia well? And little Mara?"
"Celia is... Celia!"
Partners lowered his arms with a wry grin.
"And Mara is living in Darren's town, married to a cloth merchant's boy."
"How did we get so old?"
Giljon returned his arms to his sides.
"Yesterday we were young."
"Yesterday was a long time ago."
Partners turned his attention to the merchandise.
"Too small."
He walked past Nona without further comment.
"Too timid."
He passed Sida.
"Too fat. Too young. Too ill. Too lazy. Too clumsy. Too much trouble."
He turned at the end of the line and looked at Giljon. They were of a height, though Partners looked soft where Giljon looked hard.
"I'll give you 2 crowns for the lot."
"I spent 2 crowns feeding them."
Giljon spat on the grit floor. The haggling took another hour, and both men seemed to enjoy it. Giljon enumerated the reasons why the children would become valuable fighters in Partners' contests, pointing out Geraint or Hunska traits.
"This girl here is 8.
Giljon set a hand to Sida's shoulder, making her flinch.
8 years old, tall as a tree. She's a Geraint prime for sure. A full blood, even."
"Even a full blood's only got labour value if there's no fight in him."
Partners barked a wordless shout into Sida's face. She stumbled back with a shriek of fear, raising both hands to her eyes.
"Worthless."
"She's 8, Partners."
"So her father said. She looks 15 to me."
Giljon grabbed Sida's arm and pulled her forward.
"Feel her wrists."
He pushed her head forward and ran a finger over the vertebrae, nobbling the back of her neck.
"Look here!"
He straightened her by her hair.
"Fathers lie, but bones don't. This one's a prime, at the least. Ain't seen a Geraint to beat her this trip. Could be full blood."
Partners took Cider's wrist and squeezed until she whimpered.
"She's got a touch, I grant you."
"Touch? She's no damn touch."
"Half-blood if you're lucky."
And so it went on, Partners allowing some of the children might be a touch or even half-bloods, Giljon insisting they were all primes or even full-bloods. Nona and a boy named Torum, he claimed, showed clear evidence of Hunska bloodlines. He slapped Torum, then tried again and the boy interposed his arm before the blow could land. When he tried it on Nona, she let him slap her, the hard length of his hand impacting the side of her head, leaving her ear buzzing and her cheek one hot outrage of pain. He did it again with a scowl, and she scowled back, making no effort to avoid the blow which took her off her feet and replaced the grey sky with bright and flashing lights.
"Idiot!"
Nona found herself on her feet, her shoulder in Giljon's iron grip, blood filling her mouth. She remembered the force of the slap, how her teeth had seemed to rattle.
"You saw how fast she turned towards me?"
It was true. Nona's lips felt four times their size and white spears of pain lanced up her nose. She had faced into the blow at the last moment.
"I must have missed that part," Partners said.
Nona swallowed the blood. She let the pain run through her, the cost she paid for taking money from Giljon's pocket. Some of the children sold by their own fathers almost saw the child-taker as their replacement. Stern, certainly, but he fed them, kept them safe. Nona took a contrary view. Her father had died on the ice, and what memories she kept of him warmed her in the cold, tasted sweet when the world ran sour. He would have known how to treat a man like Giljon. The Gerents had no such choice to make. Their size argued their case without need for demonstration. Though in Cider's place, Nona thought she might have agreed with Partners when he accused her of being 15. Partners took them in exchange for 10 crowns and 2.
"Be good."
Giljon, a father to them all for 3 long months, had no other words for them, climbing up behind Forefoot without ceremony.
"Goodbye."
Cider was the only one to speak. Giljon glanced her way, stick half raised for the off.
"Goodbye," he said.
"She meant the mule."
Torum didn't turn his head, but he spoke loud enough for the words to reach. A grin slanted across Giljon's face, and shaking his head he flicked at Forefoot's haunches, encouraging him through the doors that Partners's man had set open once more. Nona watched the wagon rattle off, Hessa, Marcus, Willem and Chara staring back at her through the bars. She would miss Hessa and her stories. She wondered who Giljon would sell her to, and how a girl unable to walk would make her way in the world. She might miss Marcus too, perhaps. The miles had worn away his sharp edges. The wheels had gone round and round, somehow turning him into someone she liked. In the next moment, they were all gone.
"And now you're mine,"
Partners said. He summoned the young man mending the net, lean but well-muscled under his woolen vest, hair dark, skin pale, but not so dark or so pale as Nona.
"This is James. He'll take you to Maya, who is your mother now. The slapping kind."
Partners offered them a heavy smile.
"I don't expect to notice any of you until you're this high."
He held his hand to his chest.
"And if I do, it will probably be bad news for you. Do what you're told, and you'll be fine. You're cultus now, bought and paid for."
Maya stood more than a foot taller than Partners, arms thick as a man's thighs, her face red and blotched as if a constant rage held her in its jaws. To compensate for her complexion, the ancestor had given her thick blonde hair that she braided into heavy ropes. She stood on the attic ladder after shepherding the new arrivals up it, only her head and shoulders emerging into the gloom.
"No lanterns up here, ever. No candles, no lamps. Break that rule and I break you."
She made the motion with heavy-knuckled hands.
"When you're not working, you're up here. Meals are in the kitchen. You'll hear the bell when it's time. Miss it, and you won't eat.
Nona and the others crouched close to the trap door, watching the giant. The musty air reminded Nona of James Baker's grain store at the village. Around them the shadows rustled. Cats, most likely. Rats and spiders of a certainty. But also other children watching the new arrivals. Maya raised her voice.
Don't pick on the new meat. There's time enough for that down below.
She stared at a patch of darkness seemingly no darker than any other.
I see any lumps and bumps on partners' new purchases. Denim. Regal. And I'll knock your heads together so hard you swap brains. Hear me?
A pause.
Hear me?
Loud enough to shake the roof.
I hear you.
A snarl.
Heard.
Chuckled in the distance. The others emerged as soon as Maya withdrew. Two long-limbed boys dropped from the rafters into the midst of the newcomers. Nona hadn't seen them lurking there. Others scampered in from the shadows or strolled or crept, each according to their nature. None of them as small or as young as Nona, but most of them not many years older. From the direction in which Maya had stared came a huge boy, a scowl beneath a thick shock of red hair, muscles heaped and shifting below his shapeless linen shift. Moments later, a lad near as tall but willow-thin joined him, black hair sweeping down across his eyes, a crooked smile hung between the corners of his mouth. A throng gathered, many more than Nona had anticipated, huddled and watchful, waiting to be entertained. The red-haired giant opened his mouth to threaten them.
You!
Oh, hush, Denim!
The dark-haired boy stepped in front of him.
You newbies, I'm Regal. This is Denim, soon to be apprentice and the toughest, fiercest warrior the Cultus Attic has ever seen. Look at him wrong, and he'll chew you up and spit out the pieces.
Regal glanced back at Denim.
That's the gist, ain't it?
He returned his gaze to the newbies.
Now we've got the chest thumping out of the way and saved Maya the bother of spanking Denim, you can find yourself a place to sleep.
He waved a hand airily at the gloom.
Don't tread on any toes.
Regal turned as if to go, then paused.
Sooner, rather than later, someone will try to convince you that the reason so many of us up here are titchies, like yourselves, is that partners eats children, or there's some test so deadly that almost nobody survives it. Or sometimes, Maya forgets to look before she sits down. The truth is, you've been bought early and cheap. Most of you will be disappointments. You won't grow into something partners can use. He'll sell you on.
Regal raised a hand as Denim started to speak.
And not to a salt mine or to be used as the filling in a pie, just to any place that has a need you can meet.
He lowered his hand.
Any questions?
A cracking sound filled the immediate silence, and it took Nona a moment to realize it was Denim's knuckles as he formed fists. The giant's scowl deepened.
I really hate you, Regal.
Not a question. Anyone else?
Silence. Regal walked back into the darkness, stepping rafter to rafter with the unconscious grace of a cat. Life in the Cultus proved to be a big improvement on an open cage rattling along the back lanes of an empire. Truth be told, it was an improvement on life in Nona's village. Here she might be the smallest, but she wasn't the odd one out. The isolation of the village bred generations so similar in look she might pick any handful at random to make a convincing family. Nona alone hadn't fit the mould. A goat in the sheep herd. The family Parkness's purse had furnished him with, mixed every size and shape, every colour and shade. And in the attic's gloom they were much of a muchness even so. In addition to the 4 dozen children Partners kept immediately beneath his roof, he housed a dozen apprentices and 7 fighters in their own set of rooms around the great hall. The apprentices shared a barracks house out in the rear of the compound. Nona found a spot wedged between grain sacks larger than herself. Saida had more difficulty finding a space to squeeze into and was turned away by older residents time and again, even though she dwarfed. But in the end, she settled on the boards close to Nona's sack pile, further back where the roof sloped so low that she had to roll into place. That first night the hall opened its doors and the world flowed in to see men bleed. Denham and Regal got to watch from the highest rungs of the ladder in the furthest corner of the great hall, behind counters where the apprentices sold ale and wine to the crowd. The eldest of the remaining children crowded around the trap door. Everyone else had to find some chink among the rafters through which the events below might be glimpsed. Nona's spot afforded her a narrow view of the second ring. She wondered that they called it a ring, when in fact the ropes strung between the four posts enclosed a square perhaps 8 yards on a side, the whole thing a raised platform, so that the fighter's feet were level with the average man's brow. She could see the tops of many heads, hundreds packed tight. The hubbub of their voices filled the attic. As the crowd built, so did the noise, each of them having to shout just to be heard by their neighbor. Sida lay close by, her eye to a crack. At her side, an older boy, Martin, peered through a knot-hole to which he laid ownership.
"It's all comers tonight," Martin said without looking up. "Ranking bouts on the 7 day, all comers on the 2nd, exhibitions on the 4th. Blade matches are the last day of the month."
"My da said men fight in pits in the city," Sida said timidly, waiting to be told she was wrong.
"In the Marn ports some do," Martin said. "Partner says it's a foolishness. If you got willing fighters and a paying crowd, you can put them up on a platform, not down in a hole, where only the first row can see them."
Nona lay watching the throng below her, while fights progressed unseen at the hall's far end. Her view offered only the tops of heads, but she judged reactions by the pulse and flow of the crowd. Their roaring sounded at times like the howl of a single great beast, so loud it resonated in her chest, throbbing in her own voice when she yelled her challenge back at them. At last a figure climbed into the ring beneath them. All around her Nona could feel other children scrambling for a view. Someone tried to lift her from her spot, but she caught the hands that grabbed her and dug her nails in. The unknown someone dropped her with a howl, and she put her eye back to the crack.
"Ramel!"
The voices around her echoed the cries of the mob. In the ring, he looked a heavily built man with thick blonde hair, naked, save for the white cloth bound around his groin, his skin gleaming with oil, the muscles of his stomach in sharp relief, showing each band divided from the next. Nona had glimpsed him wandering the hall earlier in the day and knew that he was enormous, taller even than Maya, and moving with none of her awkward blunder. Ramel prowled, a killer's confidence in each motion. The man was a Geraint Prime. In the attic's dimness, Nona had learned the code that Partness and Giljon had used when selling her. The range ran from touch through half-blood and prime to full-blood. A touch could be thought of as quarter-blood, and a prime as three-quarters. For Geraint's, primes often made the best fighters. Full-bloods, though rarer still and larger, were too slow, though perhaps they just said that at the cultus, as they had none to show.
"You'll see something now,"
a girl's voice excited at Nona's left. Martin had explained that any hopeful wishing to win a fight purse, or even to join the cultus, could present themselves on all-comers night, and for a crown they might pit themselves against Partness's stable.
"Ramel will kill them," Sida said, awestruck.
"He won't." Even shouting above the roar, Martin managed to sound scornful.
"He's paid to win. He'll put on a show. Killing's not good for business."
"Except when it is,"
another voice close at hand.
"Ramel does what he wants,"
the girl to Nona's left.
"He might kill someone."
She sounded almost hungry for it. A challenger entered the ring, a bald man, fat and powerful, the hair on his back so thick and black as to hide his skin. He had arms like slabs of meat, perhaps a smith given to swinging a hammer every day. Nona couldn't see his face.
doesn't Partners tell Raymel?
No one tells Raymel, the girl cut Cider off. He's the only highborn to step into a ring in 50 years. Regal said so. You don't tell the highborn what to do. The man is nothing to him.
Nona had heard the same tone of worship in the Hope Church, where her mother and Mary Streams called on the new god and sang the hymns Preacher Mickle taught them. The bell sounded, and Raymel closed with the blacksmith. Nona saw a slice of the ring, from one fighter's corner to the other's. When they stepped to the side, she lost them. Raymel moved with an unhurried precision, stopping the blacksmith's advance with punches to the head, moving back to let him recover, luring him forward into the next. It didn't seem a contest, unless you considered the blacksmith to be competing to see how many times he could stop the giant's fist with his face. The baying of the crowd rose with each impact, with each spray of blood and spittle. By the time Raymel stopped punching the smith long enough for the man to fall over, his opponent had yet to land a blow.
"Why would anyone do that?" Cider asked, lifting from her peephole, shuddering. "Why would they fight him?"
"Lot of money in that fight purse," Martin said. "It gets fatter every time someone tries and fails."
Nona kept watching as Raymel strode back and forth across the ring. She said nothing, but she knew there was more to it than money. Every hard line the fighter owned was a challenge, written across him. The masses' roar fanned the fire, but it was Raymel that lit it. "Come and try me." Two more tried before the night was over, but the fighter in the other ring, Gretcha, had more takers. Perhaps she was more of a performer, letting her opponents take a shot, putting them down with more style and less brutality. Raymel treated his foes with disdain, dropping them to the boards, bloody and humiliated. The work Maya set was neither long nor arduous, being split between more children than was necessary. In the great hall Nona polished, swept and scrubbed. In the kitchen she peeled, carried, washed, sliced and stoked. In the privies she slopped, baled, wiped and retched. Maintenance of the fight equipment, the sparring rings, the training weapons and the like all fell to the apprentices. The fighters cared for their own weapons, as would anyone who trusted their life to a sharp edge or sturdy mail. Sometimes groups of the older children were hired outside the cultus to pick fruit and dig ditches, but mostly, as Regal had said, their main task was to grow and to show the promise for which they had been purchased. Maya confided that none of them would be sold on for at least a year, probably two or three.
"Sometimes a promise won't show properly until a girl bleeds. I wasn't half my height at 13. Ain't no point Partners putting you in training until he knows what you'll be. Training costs, and it's wasted on most. Nobody ain't never going to make ring fighter without the old blood showing in them. And even when he's sure you got the gift for it, Partners likes to wait. Says best training's done when you're mostly grown into your size and speed, so you don't have to be adjusting all the time."
Twice a day Maya had the whole attic out in the yard for an hour, first clearing the fighters' weights back into their chests in the storeroom, then running endless laps regardless of rain or wind. Nona looked forward to these daily escapes from the closed-in boredom of the attic and the routine of indoor chores. She worked with Cider and Torum, who had been the last of Giljon's acquisitions, to lift the smaller dumbbells abandoned in the yard and return them to the equipment room. In truth, she and Torum were probably more hindrance than help to Cider. Denim would pass them as they struggled up the steps, one of the heavier dumbbells in each hand, just the sweat plastering the red flame of his hair to his forehead to let them know the effort he was hiding. They stopped to let him pass, then Cider led them on.
"Heave!"
Nona didn't mind that she wasn't helping much, or that her arms ached, her back hurt, and her eyes stung with sweat. She liked to feel part of something. Cider was her friend, and while she might not need Nona's help with the weights, she appreciated it. In their friendship, Nona found something absent in the faith of the village, or her mother's hope, absent in Nana Even's moral instruction, or in the bonds of family she had seen break, something she considered holy and worthy of sacrifice. Making friends came hard to Nona. She didn't see how it worked, only that sometimes it happened. She had just one friend, only briefly, and lost him. She wouldn't lose another.
"Tell me how you ended up at Harriton, child, looking up at a noose."
Abbess Glass's voice punctured Nona's remembering, and she discovered herself walking along a stony road that divided broad, windswept fields, given over to horses and sheep. Left and right, the occasional farmstead dotted the terrain. The low-gabled roofs of a villa lay ahead, and beyond that, the steep escarpment below the plateau.
"What?"
Nona shook her head. She had almost no recollection of leaving the city. Glancing back, she saw it lay a mile or more behind her, and that two nuns now flanked the abbess.
"You were going to tell me what happened with Raymel Taxis," the abbess said.
Nona looked again at the nuns, both taller than Abbess Glass, one very lean, the other with more curves to her, their habits fluttering about them. She half remembered them joining the abbess at some small gate through the city wall. One had perhaps as many years as the abbess, her face pinched and weathered, eyes cold, lips thin. The other was younger, green-eyed, returning Nona's distracted inspection, with a full smile that made her look away. Nona fixed her eyes on the horizon. The convent was no longer visible, set back from the edge of the escarpment.
Saida was told to clean the floors in Raymel's rooms. I heard her screaming.
It hadn't sounded like a person. In the village when Grey Jarry slaughtered pigs, it sounded like that. Not until one of the boys crowded around the trap door had said, "Raymel's rooms," had some cold hand taken hold inside Nona's chest and drawn her forward.
I came down the ladder, fast.
It had been slower than falling, but not much slower. She had run into the foyer. Saida had left a bucket and mop to hold the door open, a great slab of oak with scrolling brass hinges.
There were pieces of pottery all over the floor. And he was hurting her.
Saida had knocked something from its niche. She was always clumsy. Raymel had her arm in his fist, his hand swallowing it from wrist to elbow, and he had lifted her from the ground. He just stood there turning his hand from one side to the other while Saida struggled and wriggled, trying to reduce the awful strain on elbow and shoulder, shrieking all the while.
I told him to put her down, but he didn't hear me.
Nona had run to try to support her friend's weight, but Saida weighed twice what she did. Raymel noticed her then, and laughing, shook Saida so that Nona flew free. Something cracked inside his arm when he did it, loud enough to register over her screams.
So I stopped him. I cut his throat.
The younger nun snorted behind her.
They say he's 9 foot tall.
I climbed.
Raymel wasn't 9 foot, but he was over 8. He had gone down on one knee, still holding Saida off the ground by her broken arm, taunting Nona with an ugly grin on his handsome face. Nona had sprinted forward. There was time for the surprise to register in Raymel's eyes, but not for him to move. She had leapt onto his knee to gain the necessary height, then slashed her hand across his throat.
"How did you cut him?"
the older nun, from behind.
"I..."
Nona pictured Raymel, golden hair curling across an unfurrowed brow, the smile opening into something else, blood sheeting crimson from the slices she'd set deep in the meat of his neck.
"I pulled the dagger from his hip as I climbed."
"That," said the younger nun, "sounds unlikely."
Abbess Glass replied before Nona could deliver her sharp reply.
"Nevertheless, if you look more closely, Sister Apple, you will see that the girl's tunic was once white rather than brown,
A brown witch, if the guards at Harriton are to be believed, is a combination of drying blood and prison grime. Moreover, she and her friend were both to be hanged for the murder of Raymel Taxus.
"Then why isn't he dead?"
Nona asked. She wanted Raymel to be dead. "Because his father is very rich, Nona." The abbess led them from the road onto a narrower track aimed towards the towering walls of the escarpment. "Not just a little bit rich, but rich enough to buy a different mansion to sleep in every night from now until age claims him."
"Money doesn't matter when you're bleeding."
Nona frowned. Rich or poor, people looked the same on the inside. "Thurman Taxus is rich enough that he owns Academy men." The abbess hitched up her habit to help her climb the slope. "I miss my crozier already. An old lady without her stick to lean on is a sad thing indeed." Nona said nothing, not understanding the abbess's words. "Academy men. Wizards, Nona. Mages. Sorcerers. Witches and warlocks. Children with Margil blood. Educated and raised at the Emperor's expense and bound to the Ark and to his service, but free to earn a living outside the palace until such time as he requires their skills."
"They can raise a man from the dead?"
Suddenly she thought of her father, unable to remember anything of him but thick black hair and strong, safe arms. "No, but they can stop a live one becoming dead. There's a boundary, a place where we cross over to join the ancestor. Some among us can visit that boundary and hold a person there while their body heals from wounds that would otherwise make an end of them."
"So rich people never die?"
Nona wondered at it, buying off death with gold coins. The abbess shook her head. "No warlock stays by the boundary for long." Her breath came shorter now as the way grew steeper. "Thurin has a dozen warlocks working in shifts to hold his son from crossing. And many of the things that kill us, the body can't repair, no matter how much time it is given. Cut flesh, though, and lost blood. A healthy body can mend one and replace the other. The real risk is when they bring a person back to their body. There are beings that will try to follow in their wake and find a home in their minds. The longer the person is kept on the boundary, the harder it is to keep out such passengers." Nona thought of Raymel Taxus lying in his father's hall, surrounded by Academy men, sweating to keep him from death. Saida was dead. Nona had seen her feet poking beneath the sheet in the prison yard, their wrappings still stained with Raymel's blood. She had no pity for him.
"I hope he comes back full of devils, and they eat his heart."
Chapter 4 "You could send the child on her way here, Abbess." They stood at the point where the track began its steep ascent up the tumbled cliffs of the plateau, cutting back and forth across the gradient in a dozen hairpin turns. The older nun turned to Nona and pointed across the woods and fields to the west. "Moral Town is 5 miles that way. A girl could make herself useful there. Find field work." Sister Apple stood shoulder to shoulder with Sister Tallow. "The High Priest will be on this in a heartbeat. The Taxus won't even have to ask."
"Pick your fights and pick your ground, Abbess," Sister Tallow said. "Jacob would love to get his feet back under the convent table. This would be the perfect excuse."
"And you did just steal her from prison?" Apple frowned, glancing back towards the distant city.
"Mistress Blay tells me not to fight."
A smile. Then the abbess turned to begin the climb.
"And Apple tells me not to steal."
Nona started to follow her.
"Your nuns, show a little faith."
A last edge of the sun clung to the horizon as Abbess Glass led the way towards a peculiar forest of stone pillars, their shadows reaching across hundreds of yards of rock towards the traveller's approach. Nona followed, flanked by the two nuns, neither of them winded by the long climb that had set the abbess wheezing. The old one, Sister Tallow, looked as if she could climb all day. The younger, Sister Apple, at least had the decency to appear flushed. Nona, toughened by endless laps at the cultus, felt the climb in her legs and the dampness of her shift where sweat stuck it to her back, but made no complaint. The plateau, really one huge slab of rock, narrowed to a neck of land before widening into a promontory. The pillars stood across the neck from cliff to cliff, dozens deep, scores across. Abbess Glass led the way through, finding her path seemingly at random. All about them the columns, taller than trees, stretched towards the darkening sky. The place held an odd silence, the wind finding nothing to sing its tune, only stirring the dust and grit among the towers of carved stone. Nona liked it. The pillars bounded Sweet Mercy Convent on one side, and on the other the edges of two cliffs marched towards a sharp convergence. The main dome rose black against the crimson sky, a dozen and more outbuildings visible to either side. Nona followed the nuns towards its arched entrance, the weight of the day on her shoulders now, fatigue wrapping her in its dull grip, making both her anger and her sorrow grow more distant, shaping them into things that might be set apart for a night of dreams.
"You live in there?"
As they drew closer, Nona began to realize how large the dome was. The whole of the cultus would fit inside several times over, stacked on top of itself.
"That's the dome of the ancestor, Nona. The ancestor lives there, nobody else."
"Is he terribly big?"
Nona asked. Behind her, Sister Apple stifled a laugh.
"The ancestor occupies any space built in their honor. In verity, the ancestor is present in 10,000 household shrines, some into which even you would find it hard to squeeze, others larger than most houses. Here on the plateau, the church was able to give the ancestor a grander home, a gift of Emperor Perseus, third of his name."
Nona followed on in silence, her lips buttoned against the thought that the ancestor seemed very greedy, to be taking up so much room while the children at the cultus wedged themselves into any nook or cranny that would take them.
"This is my house."
Abbess Glass waved a hand at a blocky stone building looming out of the deepening shade.
"At least for as long as I am Abbess here. It's also Malkin's home."
A large grey cat lay coiled on the steps. The Abbess turned to face Nona and the two sisters.
"Sister Apple will find you somewhere to sleep, and in the morning you'll be introduced to your class. After which..."
"Class?" Nona blinked. In the village, Nana even had held class every 7 days, teaching the older children their numbers and such. Nona had tried to listen in, but Biggs chased her away as if their stupid numbers were a secret too important for her ears.
"You're here to join the convent, Nona."
Shadow hid the Abbess's face, but perhaps there was a smile there.
"If you want to. And that means living here and learning all the things a sister needs to learn. There are classes every day except 7 days.
She turned and walked away.
"Come, Nona."
Sister Apple held out her hand. Nona regarded it, uncertain whether the woman wanted something from her. After a moment, Apple returned her hand to her side and continued on around the curve of the dome. Sister Tallow followed, her habit flapping about her legs. Darkness had swallowed the plateau behind them, and the wind roamed there. Nona stared back along the path the nuns had brought her by, the pillars invisible now. The heat of the climb had left her, and the corridor wind ran sharp fingers through her cultus shift, filching any remaining warmth. It carried a salt edge. Perhaps the sea, though it lay so many miles away. Nona shivered, hugged herself, and followed the nuns. At the rear of the dome, a long, low building extended like a tail on a huddled dormouse. Sister Apple stopped at a sturdy door beneath the peak of a tiled roof. A lantern swung on a hook, sparing enough light for the nun to match the iron key she drew from her habit to the keyhole in the door's locking plate. Sister Apple lifted the lantern down from its hook, adjusting its cowl.
"These are the nuns' cells."
She kept her voice low.
"Cells?"
Nona took a step back.
"Not like prison cells.
Sister Apple smiled, then frowned. Well, quite similar, truth be told, but they're clean, and there are no locks in the doors. She stepped through the doorway. You'll sleep here tonight. If you study hard and do well, you might get to come back for another night in about 10 years. The door gave onto a long corridor. The beam of Sister Apple's lantern revealed the passage extended all the way to a black door, where it reached the dome. Left and right, repeating every few yards, a pair of round-topped doors guarded nun's cells. Sister Apple walked in, stepping softly. Sister Tallow turned without a word as they passed the third pair and passed into the darkness of the cell to the left. The black door at the end drew Nona's eyes. Something about it. 18 doors in, about half the length of the corridor, Sister Apple stopped and pushed open the door to the right. She leaned in and took a candle from the box on the wall, lighting it from the lantern. You'll be in here. There's linen and a blanket on the pallet. I'll collect you in the morning. She handed the candle to Nona. Don't start any fires. Nona watched Sister Apple walk back towards the main door, the light diminishing with her departure. Finally, the nun entered one of the cells close to Sister Tallow's, leaving Nona in her own small and flickering pool of light. The silence that had rolled back with the shadows now returned, deeper and thicker than any Nona had known. She stood, held by its completeness. No sound, not the wind's moan, not the creak of timbers or rustle of leaves, not the skittering of rats or the distant complaint of owls. Nothing. The door at the end of the corridor reclaimed her attention, although the darkness had hidden it. The memory of that door, black and polished, pressed like a finger between her eyes. Her feet wanted to take her there, her hands to set themselves flat against the smooth wood, and to feel up close the vast and slumbering fullness that lay beyond. Somewhere, a few cells back, a woman coughed in her sleep, breaking the silence and the strangeness. Freed from both paralysis and compulsion, Nona raised a hand to shield her candle's flame and advanced into the narrow room that Sister Apple had led her to. Even her cell at the Harriton had boasted a window, high and barred perhaps, but offering the condemned the sky. Nona's new cell had a slit wide enough to reach her arm through, shuttered with a pine board. She made a circle, a sleeping pallet, a pillow, a chair, a desk, a pot to piss in. Last and strangest, a length of metal running along the outer wall at ground level. It emerged from the cell to the left and vanished through the wall to the right, round as a branch and just a little too thick to close her hand around. Nona sniffed, dust and the stale air of an unused room. She went to the pallet. Heat rising from the metal stick burned on her cheeks. The whole cell held the warmth of it. Nona pulled the pallet away from the hot metal, mistrusting it. She set the candle down, pulled the blanket over her, and laid her head on the pillow. One last look at the room, and she blew out the flame. She stared at the darkness, her mind too full for sleep, certain that she would lie awake the whole night. A moment later, the clanging of an iron bell opened Nona's eyes. The door swung open, banging against the wall. Nona levered herself up from the pallet and blinked towards the entrance, the darkness now a gloomy half-light. A groan escaped her, every limb stiff and aching, though she only recalled straining her legs on the climb.
Up! Up! No slugs abed here! Up!
A small, angular woman with a voice that sounded as if it were being forced violently through a narrow hole. She strode into the cell, reaching over Nona to throw back the shutter.
Let the light in! No hiding place for sin!
Through fingers held up to defend against the daylight, Nona found herself staring into a humorless face, pinched tight around prominent cheekbones, eyes wide, watery, and accusing. The woman's head, which had seemed a most alarming shape in the gloom, sported a rising white headdress, rather like a funnel, and quite different to those the other nuns had worn the previous evening.
Up, girl, up!
Ah, I see you've met Sister Wheel. Sister Apple stepped through the open doorway holding a long habit, the outer garment grey felt, the inner white linen.
Sleeping after the morning bell she was.
The old woman raised her hands, seemingly unsure whether to strike Nona or to use them to better depict the enormity of her crime.
She's new, Wheel, not even a novice yet.
Sister Apple smiled and looked pointedly at the doorway.
A barefooted heathen is what she is.
Sister Apple spread her fingers towards the exit, still smiling. It was commendable of you to notice the cell had an occupant. The older nun scowled and ran her hands over her forehead, tucking a stray strand of colourless hair back into her headdress.
There's nothing that goes on in these cells I don't notice, sister.
She narrowed her watery eyes at Sister Apple, then sniffed hard and stalked back into the corridor.
The child stinks, she offered over her shoulder. It needs washing.
I brought you some clothes. Sister Apple lifted the habit. But I forgot how dirty you are. Sister Wheel is correct. She folded her arms over her stomach. Come with me. Nona followed Sister Apple out of the room, weaving around various nuns emerging from their cells or speaking in low tones in the corridor. A couple raised an eyebrow at her approach, but none addressed her. At one point, an angular nun brought Sister Apple to a halt by laying a hand upon her shoulder. She towered above the others, her height seemingly gained by stretching a regular woman far beyond her design, leaving her dangerously thin. Mistress Blade reports armed men beyond the pillars. An emissary came before first light.
Thank you, Flint.
Sister Apple nodded. Sister Flint tilted her head, her face so dark that in the gloom Nona could see only black eyes, glittering as they made a study of her. The nun took her hand from the smaller woman's shoulder, releasing her to her task. Sister Apple led the way out into the brittle light of morning. By daylight, Nona could see that the convent comprised so many buildings that back in the grey it would qualify as a village. She suspected it had more stone-built buildings than Flaystone, though she had only glimpsed that metropolis from Giljon's cage on the day he drove her from her home.
"Sister Flint," said men are coming. "Are they here for me?"
Nona asked. She wondered what help a score of nuns would be if Thurin Taxus had sent his warriors for her. She should have lost herself in the city when she had a chance.
"Perhaps."
Sister Apple glanced back at the great dome of the ancestor and frowned.
"Perhaps not. In any case, it would be best if you joined our order sooner rather than later. And you can't do that dirty now, can you?"
She led on at a brisk pace.
"Scriptorium, refectory, bakehouse, kitchens."
Sister Apple reeled off names as they passed various buildings. Few of them meant much to Nona, but bakehouse she knew, and the aroma of fresh bread when they passed the door filled her mouth with drool.
"The necessary?"
The nun pointed to a small building, flat-roofed and seemingly clinging to the edge of the cliff, 100 yards off.
"Necessary?" Nona asked.
"You'll go there when you need it."
Sister Apple shook her head and smiled.
"The smell will let you know it's the right place."
They passed a long range of buildings with many small square windows, all shuttered on the windward side.
Stores and dormitories.
Nona found herself observed. A dozen pairs of eyes at various of the windows. Some of the girls called out, perhaps to each other. She caught snatches carried by the wind.
"Chosen? Never. That can't be her. Peasant. She's not the chosen."
The voices followed them, words lost in the distance, but the tone still hanging in the air. Nona knew it well enough, sharp and unkind.
"Bathhouse?"
Sister Apple pointed to a squat building built of unadorned black stone, steam escaping from a row of narrow windows, only to be stripped away by the wind. The corridor winds scoured the plateau, and crossing the gap between the dormitories and the bathhouse, Nona found herself exposed to its teeth. She'd spent a lifetime learning to ignore it, just another hard edge of a hard life. But one warm night had left her soft and shivering. They reached the shelter of the bathhouse walls. The nun unlocked the heavy door and ushered Nona in. Hot, wet air wrapped her immediately, the steam reducing her vision to a few yards. Wooden benches lined the foyer, and a tall arch gave onto what might be a rectangular pool, its surface offered only in glimpses. Metal shafts ran beneath the benches in profusion.
"What if those was in my room?"
Nona pointed. "Pipes, child. They're hollow. Mineral oil runs through them. Very hot." Sister Apple nodded at the arch. "Let's get the prison filth off you." Nona started uncertainly towards the pool, wondering how deep it was, and how hot. The streams around the village never reached much past your knees, and quickly stole the feeling from everything below that point.
"You're not going in wearing clothes."
Sister Apple's voice held a mixture of amusement and exasperation. Nona turned to stare defiantly up at the nun, her lips pressed together in a puckered scowl. Sister Apple stood with her arms folded. One silent second followed the next, and at last Nona started to tug off her cultist smock, stiff with Raymel Taxus's dried blood. She made a slow and awkward job of it. In the village, even the littlest of the littles rarely ran around naked. The ice stood too close for that. Only around the harvest fires or in the all-too-brief kiss of the focus moon had Nona ever been as warm as there in the convent bathhouse.
"Hurry along, I doubt you're hiding anything unusual under there,"
Sister Apple said, pulling back her headdress as the heat got to her too. She had long hair, red and curling in the wet air. Nona stepped out of her smock, arms folded about herself, with only the steam for modesty. She made a dart for the pool.
"Wait!" Sister Apple raised a hand. "You can't go in filthy. You'll turn the water black."
She took a leather bucket from one of the many pegs lingering the walls above the benches.
"Stand over there."
She pointed to an alcove between the benches on the left. Nona did as directed, her whole body clenched. The alcove was wide enough for two or three people. The floor, tiled and perforated by finger-width holes, felt strange beneath her feet.
"What?"
An explosion of hot water stole the rest of the question. Nona wiped her eyes clear in time to see the misty outline of the nun at the poolside, having refilled the bucket.
"There's a brush on the floor. Use it."
Another wave of hot water broke across Nona's chest. Nona reached, dripping, for the brush. She'd never felt anything quite as wonderful as a bucketful of hot water. Not even fresh bread and butter came close, not even eggs, or the bacon she had smelled cooking at the cultus. If scrubbing herself with a bristly brush was the price she had to pay to get into a whole pool of it, she would scrub. Two buckets later, Sister Apple declared her clean enough for the pool. Nona ran to the edge and lowered herself in, toes questing for the bottom.
"How deep is it?"
The rising steam blinded her, the heat delicious. "This end is shallow. On you? To your shoulders?" The water reached her neck before Nona's feet found a smooth floor, and she released her death grip on the side. She stood, arms floating at her sides, sure that she had never been truly warm before. Time skipped a beat. It skipped an untold number of beats. Nona hung in the blind heat of the pool. A sharp clap brought her attention back to the world.
"Out you get. You're clean. Well, cleaner."
Sister Apple stood at the water's edge. In concession to the heat, she had hung the outer cloak of her habit up on the pegs. She clapped again.
"Out! We've both got things to do."
She pointed to the corner of the pool.
"There are steps there."
Nona went to the steps, too limp to want to struggle back over the edge. At the top she found the nun holding out a large rectangle of thick cloth towards her. It didn't seem to have any armholes or ties.
"How do I..."
Sister Apple snorted. It's a towel. She thrust the thing into Nona's hands. Dry yourself with it. Nona wrapped herself in the towel, finding